I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Treethart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
Welcome to Movies 101, the show that is proud to broadcast from this part of the Inland Northwest, or actually any part of the West, because, simply stated, the West is the best. That sentiment, in the sense of a movie genre, is on our docket this week as we set ourselves to discuss two movies, both, curiously enough, filmed by foreign-born directors that evoke Western sensibilities. The first is British filmmaker James Samuel's The Harder They Fall, a take on the classic Western story featuring a mostly black cast. The second is The Power of the Dog, New Zealand filmmaker Jane Campion's adaptation of Thomas Savage's novel set in 1925 Montana. Let's begin this week's show by talking about a movie that rewrites the whole essence of the Western myth. That movie is titled The Harder They Fall, and it's writer-director James Samuel's second attempt at making a Western featuring a primarily black cast, the first one being 2013's They Die at Dawn. That film, which is more of a short, actually features some of the same real-life characters, Nat Love, for example, in Stagecoach Mary, that Samuel includes in his new Netflix offering. This time around, Nat Love, played by Jonathan Majors, reunites his gang when he hears that his nemesis, Rufus Buck, played by Idris Elba, has been released from jail. Many of the traditional themes are here, from an overarching quest for revenge to the obligatory climactic shootout, and they are put in service by Samuel, with help by co-screenwriter Boaz Yakin, in a world that reimagines how we see the Old West. Yes, there were black cowboys and gunslingers, though it's unlikely they resembled Majors, Elba, or any of the rest of the cast, which includes the likes of Regina King, Lakeith Stanfield, Zazie Betts, and Delroy Lindo. That hardly matters, though, because The Harder They Fall, though violent in the vein of, say, Quentin Tarantino's westerns, The Hateful Eight and Django, is overall smashing entertainment, melding themes of 60s-era spaghetti westerns with 70s-era blaxploitation films. Think of Shaft on Horseback, and boasting a rousing musical score and soundtrack that perfectly serve musician-filmmaker Samuel's historically subversive intent.
Let's be clear about this film right up front. It is violent, so let's make sure everybody's aware of that particular fact. But it's a Western, so of course it's going to be violent. And I do not think it's gratuitously so, but it does start to go a little over the top at the end, just saying. Now, I loved this film, and I think the reason why I love this film is because there were such amazing performances by everyone who is in this cast. And although, Dan, you alluded to the fact that all of the characters in this story are real live people, and the filmmaker tells us that up front, their paths really didn't cross. I mean, they settled in the West at different time periods and different locations and so forth. So bringing all of these notable black people who were real life individuals and bringing some of the greatest black actors of our time together in one place was a feat that is notable just in and of itself. But I have to say, as everyone probably remembers, I'm a big Idris Elba fan, you know, going back to The Wire in particular. But,
you know, you haven't brought that up in a long time.
I know. But I have to say that Jonathan Majors, who plays his, I guess, counterpart protagonist, just captures the screen like no one else. And even though he's not as classically handsome as Idris Elba, you really can't take your eyes off of him when he's on the screen. And I would say something similar about Regina King. I mean, she sort of walks in or saunters into this movie and just takes it over. But the story is a little funky in terms of it's a revenge tale. It's a tale about settling the West. It's a tale about relationships. It's a tale about group loyalty and group think. It's a tale about race and racial tensions. And at its core, I thought that this worked really well. And there's one scene where the members of these two opposing gangs, I guess you would say, decide that they have to go to the white town. And that was one of my favorite scenes in the movie because it was truly a white town.
Literally.
Yeah, throughout and in every respect. And I thought Zazie Betts brought the sensibility to Stagecoach Mary that was really nuanced in terms of her. When we see her in different scenes, she really sort of changes who she is and how she is. And I thought the cast worked really well together. Cinematography, of course, I did see this at home. We do have some shots that probably would have benefited from being seen in a large theater setting. But overall, I really appreciated this film.
The first thought I had when I started watching The Harder They Fall was, well, first of all, what a cast. I mean, there's yeah. an opening credit sequence where we get these kind of stylized shots of everybody that's going to be in the movie and their character names. And every actor was like, they're in this too? They're in this? Delroy Lindo's in this? I mean, it was just so exciting to see the cast that this movie had assembled. So that was great. And then as soon as we got these big, wide sweeping shots of, you know, the American frontier, which I think we'll talk about more in the second half of the show, I thought, I wish I was seeing this in a theater with a big booming sound system and a big screen and maybe a packed, rowdy audience.
Some of the most amazing actors of our time.
Yeah, they look great on screen, and the surroundings are amazing. So yeah, I wish that this had gotten a theatrical release.
The set design, the costumes, the music, I expect you to talk about that a little bit.
Right, and what's amazing is that this is his first feature-length film. Mm-hmm. I mean, he made a short, and he made the 51-minute They Die at Dawn, which is kind of a precursor to this movie. Got some of the same characters, Nat Love and Stagecoach Mary, but it's Michael K. Williams.
R.I.P.
R.I.P., poor Michael.
Speaking of The Wire.
But, you know, there was nothing about The Harder They Fall that I didn't appreciate on some level. Is it a perfect film? No, but it captures the feel of those classic Westerns, but totally reinvents it.
Yeah, no, I just think that this movie is a lot of fun. And even though it's dealing with all of the tragic Western themes, I mean, you mentioned the spaghetti Westerns of the 1960s, and certainly those were an influence here. And the plot itself, I mean, it's right out of something like Yojimbo or The Seven Samurai, these kind of warring factions taking over a town. But I was also thinking about Tarantino all the way through. I mean, this almost feels like an homage to the Tarantino homages. I mean, not only do you have these big expressive title cards that take up the whole screen, but you have the deliberately anachronistic needle drops because, of course, James Samuel is a music producer himself and has directed music videos. So that's all over here. And one of the producers of this movie was Lawrence Bender, who produced all of the early Tarantino movies.
That's
so
right.
I think that was deliberate here. But I mean, of course, Tarantino's Western homages are so hung up on the idea of racism, the history of racism in the American West or in America in general. And I think that this movie takes those themes but subverts them in a way I was not expecting because, as you said, most of the cast is these black actors in these powerful roles, and they take the lead, and it's the white characters are the supporting players here. So I thought the way that the screenplay was kind of making you think it was going to go the way that something like Django Unchained or even The Hateful Eight went, and then it goes off in a totally different, much more contemporary direction, I found really refreshing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would love to see a sequel of this, but I'm not sure who's left alive. I'm not sure that should be a problem.
Could resuscitate. Trudy Smith is still alive. That's that last shot in the film. That's her. She gets beat up by Stagecoach Mary, but, you know, I don't want to give away too much.
No, I mean, I guess I don't know if I want to wish a sequel of any movie into the world because so often we rue the day that we wish there was a sequel to even good movies. And The Harder They Fall is a very good movie. But I want to talk about the filmmaking because it is really surprising that this is a first feature because it feels so confident, not just in terms of the staging and the shot composition, but just the tone of this thing because it is fun and jazzy in a lot of places, and it moves, but then it will stop. And another kind of Tarantino-esque hallmark, you get these long monologues where the characters sit and explain their motivations and where they came from and why they are the way that they are. And some of them are very dark and very violent. And the way that Samuel is able to kind of mix all of these things together without making it seem like oil and water, that's something that a lot of filmmakers, it takes them a few films before they figure that out. And so just the confidence of this movie, and you get the sense that these actors, some of whom have worked with our greatest directors, they just seem to be having a blast working together and working with this guy. I mean, just the fun of this movie kind of radiates off of it. It has a swagger.
So you compare that to Rust and the film set of Rust.
Oh, yeah, that's...
That went in a completely different direction.
Exactly.
The other thing is, it's my understanding that the music was not added after. As you were pointing out, it's integrated throughout. And I think that that's a real plus because you can sort of feel the change of tone as you
indicated. It becomes almost a character in and of itself. Yeah, and I think that we can't let go without pointing out, once again, let's stress, this is a violent movie. But anybody who's ever seen anything directed by Quentin Tarantino...
This is tame compared to Tarantino.
Exactly.
But I mean, what do you expect from a shoot-'em-up Western? I mean, that's what you get with this.
Yeah. And that was our discussion of The Harder They Fall. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Power of the Dog. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
It's that time of year when it's nice to connect with each other, maybe especially with someone we haven't seen or talked to in a while. How about writing a letter? I'm Andy Tagle from NPR's Life Kit with some tips and tricks for putting pen to paper. First, grab your favorite pen, some nice stationery, or that souvenir postcard you've been holding on to. Second, be specific. Details paint a full picture and deepen your relationship with the recipient. Finally, be open. When you share your personal experience, you're inviting the same in return. Writing a personal letter can foster connection, boost your creativity, and, of course, brighten someone's day. At NPR and this station, we strive for those same goals every day by connecting with you. You can deepen that relationship and expand your community with a donation. Here's how to reach out.
You can make a difference with your contribution at SpokanePublicRadio.org. And thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed James Samuel's The Harder They Fall. Let's now move to Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog. First, let's deal with that title. It comes from a line in the 22nd song, one version of which goes, "Deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog." It's not hard to see who holds the power and perhaps fills the role of the dog in Campion's movie, which is based on the 1967 novel by American writer Thomas Savage. It's Phil Burbank, the tough and taciturn man played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who runs a successful Montana cattle ranch with his more introverted brother George, played by Jesse Plemons. Phil is at first nonplussed, then angry when George, with whom he has long lived alone, sleeping in the same room, suddenly marries the widow Rose, played by Kirsten Dunst. Phil embarks on a savage campaign to intimidate not just Rose, but also her bookish son, played by Cody Smit McPhee. Just why he does this is never made clear, just as many aspects of Savage's story are left to our imagination, though it does become obvious that Phil has his private demons. Campion shot her film in New Zealand, the scenic landscapes of which make Montana look even more majestic than it actually is, and she uses the dissonant musical score of Johnny Greenwood to add to the film's dreamy thematic disharmony. If only she had added just a bit more context to the actual plot.
Okay, you lost me there, because I think, first of all, I think The Power of the Dog does give us enough context to understand why the things that happen the way they do. But I also think that if this had had more context, if Campion had explained herself more, I think the mystery of this movie and the intrigue of this movie would have been lost completely. You would have just had another standard kind of Western character piece, and that is not what this is. It's a lot of things, but it takes its time in divulging what it's actually going to be about. The way that this story is structured, I had no idea where it was going. And once it got to... I looked at my watch and thought, okay, there's about 20 minutes of this movie left. What could possibly happen? And a lot happens in the last 20 minutes. And you go, oh, that's what this movie has been about this whole time? It's kind of a really great sleight of hand act in a way. And I'd be curious to know how much of that comes from the original novel, which I think is something like 50 years old and is being adapted for the first time. I'm curious to go back and read it now. But I think what this movie is really about, without getting into any spoiler territory, is I think it's about, I mean, we talked about the American frontier and the brutality of it in the first half of the show, and that continues here. But I think the brutality of this movie is so much more blunt and far less stylized than it is in something like The Harder They Fall. I mean, just the shots of how the ranch hands treat the animals that they're dealing with are so bludgeoning and intense. And I mean, I think a lot of people are going to be looking away from the screen. And if you're bothered by depictions of animals in distress, I wouldn't even bother with this one. But of course, that's how the Wild West was. It was a dirty and bloody and violent place. And there's this sense of menace that's just humming underneath every scene of this movie. Something horrible always seems about to happen. And yet in most scenes, nothing horrible does happen. And so we're holding our breath all the way through until eventually the bottom does inevitably fall out. But I just think that Jane Campion is such a great filmmaker. The command of pacing and tone and visual style, the way that she juxtaposes these wide open spaces with the almost claustrophobic nature of this. I mean, it's a big house in the middle of nowhere that these brothers live in. Yeah. And yet it starts to really become a prison, especially for the Kirsten Dunst character. And I also have to say that when Benedict Cumberbatch showed up as this, I mean, he's almost like the closest character I could compare him to is maybe like Robert Mitchum in Night of the Hunter. He comes in and he's so oily and creepy and
cringy,
and predatory. And he comes in and I thought, I don't know if I'm going to buy this actor in this role. And by the end, I was convinced. Benedict Cumberbatch's performance in this movie is stellar. And so I don't know if I love The Power of the Dog quite as much as a lot of critics seem to, but man, it hooked me. It entranced me. And I have not stopped thinking about it since I saw it in the theater. It's on Netflix now, and I might have to watch it a second time.
It's also playing at the Magic Lantern.
And it's playing at the Magic Lantern, which you see it on a big screen if you can. But I may have to see it again because I'm almost certain that it will enrich and grow in estimation
Be able to look off in the hills and see something that's there. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Nathan, you sort of lauded the pacing of the movie, and this isn't really a pacing issue per se, but I think the movie does shift gears at different points. And so initially we have the story between the two brothers, and then we have the sort of story between Rose and George, and then her son gets introduced and becomes part of that duo. And then it sort of shifts to focus on Benedict Cumberbatch and his relationship with the ranch hands, and then his course of dealing with the son and so forth. And I sort of felt as though the Jesse Plemons character, so George and Rose, played by Kirsten Dunst, as we pointed out, and they're married or together in real life, that story sort of got put on the back burner in this kind of strange way, to my way of thinking.
Yeah, and George just kind of disappears.
Yeah, I mean, he just sort of, and it's like, is he still alive? Like, what's going on?
And Kirsten Dunst, as good as she is in this movie, she is a little too quivery.
Well, she doesn't have a whole lot to do in the end.
Yeah.
Like, I think that I would have appreciated maybe a few more face-offs with the Benedict Cumberbatch character or whatever, just to sort of keep those two individuals in the film
he's
more.
He's so brutal to her.
Oh,
emotional way that's almost hard to.
She's trying
look
to play
at
the piano and he's whistling. It's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be clear that when I'm talking about adding more context to the actual plot, it's simply because there are parts of the story, and I'm sure they obviously come from Savage's novel, in which we learn things about Phil that are uncomfortable. And there's a part of him that it seems to me that, oh, this is his problem? Oh, because he's trying to
compensate for something.
Compensate and stuff these urges that he has. I was really uncomfortable with that because that's like victimization. That's like, you know, and it bothered me. And so if there had been less of that, or if that had been eliminated and he had simply been this creepy guy who we don't know why he's acting, then I might have appreciated it more. The sense of mystery that you were talking about might have worked better.
Yeah, but the revelations about Phil, the Benedict Cumberbatch character, at first kind of rubbed me the wrong way as well, because I thought, oh, here we go. We've seen this before.
Right.
Yeah.
This is predictable. But the reason that it works so well this time is because Campion lets that enrich a character who we thought was just a standard one-dimensional villain. And if we don't have that revelation, then he is just a standard one-dimensional villain. And I think it makes us think differently about everything we've seen before, about the reason that he treats certain characters the way that he does, the way he acts the way that he does. And it also makes us kind of weirdly empathize with a character that we don't want to empathize with. And yet, she doesn't then make him into some kind of softy or say, well, now that we've diagnosed his problem, for lack of a better term, then now he's going to let his guard down and become more of an approachable human being. And that doesn't happen. And I find that kind of complexity be very intriguing.
It ends up being almost an Alfred Hitchcock.
And more complex than I think you're giving it credit for.
Well, and then we have this specter of Bronco Henry that pervades the entire film. And we go back and forth with our perceptions of who he was and how he was and what he was, and also the context in which Phil, Benedict Cumberbatch's character, places him. And so we are always trying to figure out, was Bronco Henry a hero? Was he an abuser? Was he a father figure? Was he something else?
Yeah. And I think it becomes pretty obvious, though. Uh-huh.
Yes. And I think as time goes on, yes. But I did like the performance, especially, we don't really know what to make of the son. And I really did like...
Although there's a couple of scenes that shock you about him also.
Yep.
It's like,
right.
It's like, oh, yeah, he can do these flowers, but ooh, what does he do with that rabbit?
Uh-huh. So we think we know where Peter is coming from, too. And gradually there's a reveal with respect to who he is and what his priorities are. And so I think I will have to see this again. And I don't often say that about movies, but I do think that Benedict Cumberbatch's performance... is an award-winning performance
I think we can both agree on at least two things. One, Benedict Cumberbatch is terrific in this film, and the cinematography is amazing.
And I want to see more Jane Campion movies. This is her first feature film since like 2008 or 2009.
Yeah.
And just, this is a filmmaker at the top of her game. Yeah. And the way that this fits into her overall filmography and the themes that she's fascinated by, you could write a thesis on it.
Top of the Lake, that series?
Oh, sure.
She was amazing in that. And that was our discussion of The Power of the Dog, which is playing at the Magic Land Theater. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinbend and Marie-Pat Truthart and I discussed The Harder They Fall. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarbrick for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the writer Richard Slotkin. The return of the last American combat forces from Vietnam in 1973 marked the sudden end of the preeminence of the Western among the genres of mythic discourse. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.